March is colorectal cancer awareness month, and the American Cancer Society told us there were more than 4,400 cases reported in Michigan in 2004. Of those, more than 1,800 of them were fatal. Our station manager, Ralph Iden, recently talked with a local resident who is battling the disease for her perspective on living with the disease and the impact it has had on her life and family.
I'm talking with Elizabeth Parcells, who many of us in Huron County, or at least a certain segment, know as the curator of the Huron City Museums. But there's another side to Elizabeth that perhaps a few people here know, but largely we don't. So, Elizabeth, first of all, who is Elizabeth Parcells?
Well, hi. my early claim to Huron County is my ancestry, of course. My great-great-grandfather having been Langdon Hubbard, who was a lumberman in the late great 19th century. And we've had that family farm in Huron City for many, many years now. I think last year we celebrated 150 years. And Elizabeth Parcells, besides that, is a classical singer. That is, I was raised in Michigan, and I went to school on the East Coast to the New England Conservatory, and then spent about 20 years of my singing career in Germany, in Europe, and sang in the opera houses there. And then in 1997, I returned to Michigan to take up permanent residence here, and then spend as much time as I could in Huron County, which is my, I think of it as my first home.
That's terrific, and of course you modestly have not mentioned the fact that if I were to go to the internet and type in the name Elizabeth Parcells, especially under the Google, I'm not sure if the different search engines have different results. But we certainly get a lot of returns on Elizabeth Parcells with things like internationally acclaimed soprano, for example. So you're being a little modest here.
Well, I've never been good at tooting my own horn, I guess. To me, with that type of thing, that's I'm always the last to know, if you know what I mean. I just get out there and work and do my job and sing, and I leave it up to everybody else to make the qualitative statements. That's not for me to say.
Well, certainly, you've had a long and colorful career, and I know that in some cases it's probably been a very, exhausting career because of your travel and the various performances around. You've done some opera performances and certainly just came off a performance at Carnegie Hall.
That's right. I'll tell you more about that concert in a minute, but as far as the traveling, the day I left Michigan as a freshman to the conservatory, I've been traveling ever since, and my going away present was a set of Hartmann luggage that had a lifetime guarantee, but they're all sprung. I wore them all out, so much for that. I traveled a lot, and at the end of it all, I'm back in Michigan, where I feel the most at home, where my language is spoken and I know the people. It sounds like a small thing, but if you've traveled as much as I have, that's a very big thing. And the concert in Carnegie Hall was sponsored by a foundation called Pro Musicus, which has been sponsoring my recitals since 1977. And they invited me back for this concert as an alum, if you will, to kind of sum up their 40 years of work in the field, presenting high-quality recitals not only for the public but also on their special community service concerts, where they go into hospitals, prisons, daycare homes, all kinds of places where those audiences are unable to get to a normal concert hall. So those concerts were also extremely rewarding through the years. And we did one of those in New York this time. We went to St. Joseph's Catholic School in Chinatown, and many of those children had not heard a Western classical style singer before, and it was an interesting day to explain 500 years of culture to Chinese children who were, their civilization was going when we were all still living in caves. But it was fascinating, and the kids were great, and it was a very rewarding trip.
That's great. You also have several CDs or records, as the case may be, depending, I guess, on the decade.
Mm-hmm. Starting in, well, early on, of course, nobody keeps their LPs around anymore, but there were a few student productions in the early days. And then in 1983, just as the CD technology was coming along, I sang with the Luxembourg Orchestra. I did a Bach cantata, which got onto a CD. And not long after that, I sang what we called a Jenny Lind gala. Jenny Lind was the famous Swedish nightingale of the mid-19th century. And we did a kind of a musical reenactment of her great tour to America, in which she was sponsored by Phineas T. Barnum. And she never got to here in the city or to here in county, but several years ago, I think in 1995, I brought Jenny Lind to here in the city in her beautiful white dress and the whole thing, and we had a Jenny Lind evening. And so 100 years later, Jenny Lind made it to here in county. If you want to think of it that way.
Very good. Well, now, from kind of a lively career, you had a kind of a bad news day sometime in July of 2003. What happened?
Well, that's correct. I'd been noticing there was something kind of wrong with me, and I pointed it out to the doctor, and one thing led to another, and I was diagnosed with advanced colon cancer. Not very happy news at all. I remember commenting at the time, this is going to be nothing but trouble. And I've been quite right about that. It's been quite a journey since then through the treatments and the various ups and downs that go with a situation like that. But I'm happy to say that I'm coming out the other end at the moment. I'm together enough to get back to a little bit of singing on a limited basis. This trip to New York, I did as a life-affirming action on my part to... I don't know, it was something to shoot for, a goal, something to get me going, and I hope to keep goals out in front of me from here on in to keep me active.
What was the prognosis back then?
They said without treatment it could be a year or less, and that's pretty devastating when you hear that, when you look around and you say, hey, they're talking about me. You have a sense of disbelief, and... kind of like you're floating around 2 feet above everybody else and this isn't happening. That's how you feel when they give you that kind of news. But he said with treatment, if the treatment worked well, I could look forward to some more years. But again, not exactly a formula for longevity, so that one suddenly has to telescope one's ambitions into a much shorter amount of time than you thought is really the truth of it. Suddenly everything is a lot, your life has been compacted down to a few more years, not a few more decades as you had thought.
Right.
It's definitely turn your head on a dime. So part of the struggle is to deal with that reality, understanding our mortality and knowing that really when you get right down to it now, right now is all we ever had. And start living in the moment, start living in the now, and get into the now habit. Take care of things, do it now, and that becomes a whole different approach to life.
Well, and that, speaking of doing it now and so on, you say it was diagnosed advanced. Were there warning signs in advance that perhaps were ignored?
Oh, yes. That's very often the case with younger people. That is, colon cancer was traditionally thought of as an old man's disease. And it does strike women, and it does strike ever younger people. The problem is that the cancer screening for colon begins officially at the age of 50. And I personally believe it should begin much sooner than that. We're seeing much younger people coming down with colon cancer in their 40s, in their 30s. It's kind of scary. Now, there are statistically less occurrences in that age group. But if you think of yourself as a statistic of one, you don't want to be on that side of the statistic. So that younger people are usually caught with the disease at an advanced stage because the warning signs are either nil to negligible and go ignored. You know, you have a little upset stomach or a little this or that, a little bad day or something, you chalk it up to stress, or I ate something I shouldn't have or something. You have no idea that it could be something that serious. And so, yeah, it does kind of sneak up on you. And at 50, absolutely, I mean, the ideal 50th birthday present would be a colonoscopy. But I think that the vigilance needs to begin sooner than that in all cancers, but in particular colon cancer, it's one of the most commonly occurring in the cancer spectrum, you know, second only to lung and breast and prostate. But colon cancer, because of the nature of it, also has a higher mortality than some of the more frequently occurring cancers. So, yeah, it's not a joke, and you shouldn't toy with it. So one of the things I did at my latest concert, I took 200 buddy bracelets down there. Those are cancer awareness bracelets, little kind of trinkets, actually, but they're all the rage right now. Everybody's wearing awareness bracelets. And I passed them out to the audience and said, if you can save a life by reminding someone who needs a colonoscopy to get it, for goodness sake, then this whole thing would be worthwhile. So I'm becoming quite the activist and a bit of a nag. But it's a very important message.
You took a couple of months off of your treatment program in order to go ahead and do the concert at Carnegie.
That's correct.
Was that a good move?
No one will ever know. That's the thing. You take the treatments. Either they help you or they don't. They are very difficult. They set you back. They make you feel horrible. But the alternative is to simply accept your fate. Now, I'm too young to do that. I've still got a lot of plans, and I want to keep going for a while. So, obviously, the no-treatment idea is not appropriate for me. But taking a few months off of treatment after having taken treatment for over a year, I was exhausted, frankly. You reach a certain point and you just can't tolerate anymore, and you need to take a break. You know, it was my own personal decision. I took that break, and I did something I dearly wanted to do, and Monday I'll start my treatments again like a good girl. I'll be docile and go right on back to it and do as I'm told. But I think if there's something you need or want to do in your life, and taking a break from chemo will help you do that, that's just as important for your life as staying on treatment and maybe squeezing a few extra weeks out of it. It was a kind of a flip a coin thing, but I made a decision for myself for which I take full responsibility, and whether it was a good or bad move, I don't know. I really don't. It may have affected the timing, but certainly not the outcome. So I feel that it was worth it for myself.
And that is, as you say, a decision only you could make. I'm imagining that your doctors or your medical advisors were advising against the pause.
We had a deal going in. It's kind of funny. I mean, a lot of people who have never been sick before have never had to sit in conference with a doctor and talk frankly about things like this. And the way the conversation went at the very beginning was that because of the nature of my condition and of the prognosis and so on, that all of these steps were going to be my decisions. It was up to me. And this is the decision thing. I mean, it's like, what, you want me to decide these things? I've never been to medical school. I think to myself, how can I make this kind of decision when I feel so insecure about the information that I have to base my decision upon? That's very difficult. And yet in a situation like this, we're being faced with decisions that we have to make the decision even though we don't have the information required to know how that decision is going to affect one way or the other. And the fact is the doctors don't know everything either, and they admit it freely. It's say every patient is different. Everybody's got a different chemical makeup, spiritual makeup, and each patient, especially a patient that is reasonably well-informed and spiritually stable and able to take care of themselves, a responsible patient should take a decision-making role in their treatment and in the progress of the whole thing. I think that's smart. It also relieves others of this very heavy burden of responsibility. That is to say, I take full responsibility for myself, and nobody else on earth needs to feel guilty about what I decided because it was my call. I think that's very important.
It has to be really difficult to make those calls, as you say, because of the lack of information, lack of background. It's almost like going over to the casino, I suppose, in a way.
It is, and yet some of the skills I learned in my career as a singer, of research, learning, I've learned several languages in my life, and each time I tackle a new piece, it's another system. And I figure if I can learn how to, for instance, everything that goes into performing in an opera or a concert, if I can learn that, I can research this and learn as much about it as I can, which I've done, and God bless the Internet, because there is a wealth of information. If you don't mind slogging through all of the medical terms and looking things up and things, you can find out just about anything you need to know. If it can be known, it's on the Internet. And that's been a wonderful tool for me, because I at least have the confidence of knowing that I've studied the subject to the best of my ability, so that I know how to ask the doctor the right questions and then make up my own mind.
Certainly, you've taken a proactive stance on this. In your research on the Internet, did you come across many of the so-called miracle cures?
But that was one of the other, that was another promise I made to myself right from the beginning, that I wasn't going to descend into desperation. I wasn't going to start taking what I call peach pits, which is the Laetril. Mm-hmm. Still offer those treatments in Mexico. And there are a number of other homeopathic things that I'm not discounting that entire realm. I'm merely saying that there are treatments that have been proven clinically to be effective, and one should not replace those treatments with the homeopathic ones. That's my personal opinion, that we should take advantage of the science that we have, which is quite amazing. I have a news catcher on my Internet that everything that comes down about advances in colon cancer treatment come to me as email. And it's just amazing the things they're researching and coming up with. And therefore, one should avail oneself of the best standard of treatment and even some of these newer things to the best of your ability. Now, on the other side of it is your daily life. How can I just feel better? How can I keep my appetite, be pain-free? How can I feel good about myself in the day-to-day? Which, you know, there's no doctor and no nurse talking to you when you get up in the morning and feel awful. You have to do something for yourself. And that's where perhaps some of these other preparations could come in handy to make you just feel better. I wouldn't discount that. But I can't believe that that the homeopathic or the natural cures are really as effective as we wish they were. Then you look to a higher power, you know, and you say, well, is there something coming from on high? Well, sure, it happens all the time. I survived cancer when I was a child, and I wasn't expected to make it, and I did, and nobody knows why. So I've already been the recipient of a miracle. But I like to say, I look in my coupon book to see if there are any miracles left. And that's not for me to say. Again, when we recognize a higher power, we have to also recognize a higher wisdom. And that means that maybe we disagree with what the higher wisdom has in store for us. But we accept it nonetheless.
You've obviously not allowed the cancer to certainly it does control some of your life, but you've not allowed it to overpower and completely rule you.
Oh, no, no. If I'd done that, I never would have gone to Europe. I never would have sung or accomplished the things I did in my life because I lived under the shadow of a cancer recurrence for my whole life. And at some point or other, you just have to get up and go and say, well, if I'm anticipating or worrying about something that hasn't happened yet, that's going to hold me back and I'm not going to get anything done in my life. Why not take a chance? And if something happens later on, so be it, but don't miss your opportunities that you have right now to get on with your life. So I think one of the hardest things spiritually is when you've been told that the meter's ticking on your exit, you know, that, mm-hmm. not, you know, it's going to be shorter than you thought. One would tend to say, well, what's the use? You throw up your hands, you say, what's the use? And then months, even years will go by when you're surviving. Well, what do you do with this information that said you were going to check out before too very long? Can you allow that to become foremost in your mind and your consciousness? Can you allow that thought to bring you down day after day after day? I don't think so. I think the meaning of life is life, and life is every day. So no, and it's the short answer is no. I don't let it rule me.
And certainly, you know, I think anybody listening, those who have not been through it, either themselves or maybe with another family member, can't perhaps fully appreciate the personal devastation that sets in when you hear that news.
That's true, but fortunately, most of us walk around partaking of the grace of God that they have happy, healthy lives and without undue problems. That's a wonderful state of being, and I enjoyed every moment of the time that I had believing that, walking around in Europe and having a wonderful life and coming back to Michigan and all the rest of it, my wonderful family and my great friends and the interests I have. Those are wonderful things, and every one of us has problems, and we all get bad news from time to time, either about somebody else or about ourselves. It sounds a little trite, but I did see a movie recently where in one scene, the person going through the cancer points out to her dear one, remember that the pain of tomorrow is part of the happiness of today. That, you know, if you don't, in other words, if you don't experience great happiness, then the sorrow would be meaningless and vice versa. That if you were never happy, how could you be sad? So,
right.
I don't know. As a singer, we deal with a lot of strong emotions as our subject matter in the singing. The thing that inspires a song is strong love, strong hate, strong fear, or joy, or these are the things that inspire songs. And so when I was asked once on one of our special community service concerts, one of the inmates at this prison, he looked like a real tough character, and he asked me the most astounding question. He said, when you're singing, how do you deal with your emotions? I was very taken aback. It was like it came out of nowhere. It was such an amazing question, and I realized that I'd thought about it a lot but never verbalized. How do I deal with my emotions? When you're walking through fire without getting burned, how do you do that? How do you sing to the crowd, make everybody in the room cry except yourself? And the answer was that you compartmentalize and you think of yourself as a vessel, as a container or a conduit for those feelings. That the feelings are coming from somewhere out there, who knows where, coming through you to them. And it's like being a really good cook, you know. The food is for somebody else. You just cook it, right? So you begin to realize that you are indeed a conduit or a bringer of those things, and the reaction of your audience is up to them. Not you.
To some degree, as a singer, you're also an actress.
That's true, too.
Because of that. And Do you think that is perhaps the control that we've just discussed, or you've just discussed, do you think that has helped you deal with the whole news, the whole situation of the cancer?
I think so, very much so. For one thing, I've kept my sense of humor. I have several rather naughty jokes about serious illness, for one thing. I find illness in general to be rather humiliating. You know, think about that for a minute. But it is. I mean, you're cut off at the knees. You can't move. You're sick. It's a little humiliating. And yet, when I think about it, comedy or humor, humiliation is the soul of humor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the dignified fellow loses his pants, we all laugh. And there are moments when you break the solemnity of the hour. It's sort of like gallows humor. And you're human. You have to be many faceted in your emotions, no matter what situation you're in. If you can find humor in any situation, you're halfway there. Humor is very important. Now, about so sometimes when I'm talking to people who are devastated by what I'm telling them, then I might break it up with a little levity, and they say, "How can you do that?" I said, "How can I not?" And I try to let them know that you know, life goes on. What am I trying to say?
So you're actually, basically, you're telling them to don't stop living.
Right, and I end up consoling them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the one with the bad news, and I think I've also noticed that it's much easier to go through something like this yourself, strange as that sounds, than to watch someone you love go through it. I ascertained that that's a fact.
Right.
I've talked to more caregivers than patients, and the caregivers are frantic and worried and depressed and feeling inadequate and don't know what to do. And oftentimes the patients have a much more almost serene and accepting attitude toward their illness than their caregivers do. That's been often the case. I think it's the case in my particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
I find people around me much more upset about it than I am, which is a little ironic, but it just tells me that I couldn't remain in that kind of a mood all the time and survive.
Right.
I have to be, let's put quotes around it, normal.
Mm-hmm.
And be able to laugh and smile and go about my business in spite of what I know. And on the one hand, be honest with the people around me so that they're on the same page. So it's like, what, you never told me, or something like that. Sure, I told you. I told you, now you know, now let's change the subject and get on with it. And that's a hard moment. And so at the beginning, I took care of that right away, as soon as I knew, and was able to write letters and get on email. I informed everybody I knew of my situation, kind of went public on it, and said, okay, now that's done.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to, like, do it by degrees, you know, everybody I meet. Is it a need-to-know basis, or should we just make it common knowledge and get it over with? And it depends on your situation, again. If you're not as seriously ill, you might not want everybody to know, because you know you're going to get over it. But in my case, you know, what the heck? Might as well have everyone know. It's just as well, and it's easier on me.
Now, there probably is a point at that early part of it, where you made that decision to go public, if you will, where you must have had that period of time where you were devastated by the news and so on. How did you reach that stage where you felt, for want of a better word, comfortable with telling the rest of the world about the situation?
Well, I may be a little different than others because I've done the cancer thing before. And even though I was very small at the time, it did cloud my childhood, and I understood my mortality from the beginning. And it may be that I wasn't quite as devastated. In other words, as a former cancer patient, 50 years of remission or of cancer-free is a long, long time in anybody's book.
Mm-hmm.
But I always sensed that someday the other shoe would fall and that I could recur or get some other cancer. I think anyone who has had a history of cancer is on watch for the rest of their lives. There's just no two ways about it. So it's almost with a sense of relief that they said, well, here it is. I said, oh, okay, well, it happened. It really did happen. And it was a surreal moment, really, so that I don't remember being fearful or upset about it. It's hard to explain. It seemed to be the logical conclusion to a long life dealing with these issues. And I've never thought I was going to live forever anyway, so... And I say to people who are upset when they hear that you're going to die, dum-de-dum-dum, say, well, you knew that going in. We are mortal, after all. That was part of the deal. And I guess my favorite epitaph that I read someplace was on some headstone somewhere was, this is what I expected, just not so soon. And, that, you know, one could get a little crabby about being reaped in the prime of your life, but even that is sad to a limited degree, mm-hmm. and doesn't really reach me, because I only know where I am right now or what I am right now. I don't know what I would have been, and I don't know how my life is going to change the world. I don't have ambitions of that nature. I want to be comfortable and happy, and I'm satisfied with that. So if other people are terribly worried, I want to find a way to help them conquer their fear. Because when they're upset for you, they're in a way, they're upset for themselves. If this could happen to her, it might happen to me. It's frightening. It's for some people, it's terrifying. You know, I'm not saying that I can walk on water or anything, or that I'm not above it all. There are fears. Mostly my fears are in the direction of, will I be able to get the best care that mm-hmm. I can. And that's, when I think of human systems being flawed as they are, I work the hardest on that, on the things that I can control. In other words, I'm not trying to fight the things I can't control. I'm trying to do my best with the things that I can influence.
And that's all any of us can do, I think.
I think so.
What does the future hold for Elizabeth Parcells?
I'm not sure. I never knew. I mean, my career has always been, I've never been able to see around the next bend in my career, but I always had faith that even if I went a couple of weeks with no offers, the phone would eventually ring, and it always did. I feel the same way about my life now. I cannot see what is ahead, but I have faith that good things are still in store for me, that the phone will ring, someone wants me to sing. The phone will ring, hey, come down to the hospital, we've got a new clinical trial for you to consider. Or some genius out there, and there are millions of brains working on the problem as we speak, will come up with some silver bullet. I can't insist on that. Again, miracles, you can believe in miracles, you can know they exist, but it's very hard to ask for a miracle for yourself. I ask for miracles for other people all the time, but somehow or other, I have faith that a miracle is possible, and yet I humbly wait my turn, as it were.
Sure. Well, you've been invited to perform, I believe, toward the end of the year.
Yeah, that's amazing. He didn't know I was ill, but this is an old school friend of mine, wonderful tenor named Wayne Rivera. He called me asking, he got my postcard about the Carnegie concert, figured I was still in the game, so he called me up and asked if I would come in November to Hartford to sing on a concertante, that is, a concert performance without staging and costumes, of an opera by Bellini. And those are usually pretty tour de force daunting parts. They're very advanced for singing. And I I had to say, you know, 2 years ago I'd have told you, yeah, I'll be there for sure. Now, if you're willing to work with me, old friend, let's hire an excellent alternate, a B-cast, and see where the chips fall. I think that's going to be my decision, that I'll try to stay in it. Again, that goal, speaking selfishly, is very important to me. However, do I know that I'm going to be there and actually accomplish that? No, I don't know anymore. That's the one thing that kind of burns me up about this, that my life is less predictable than it used to be. I can't say 2 years from now, yes, on this evening I can sign a contract, a thing. When the stick goes down, I'll be ready. I can't say that in my particular situation.
But you're still willing to say pencil me in.
Yes, I'm still saying pencil me in. Absolutely.
What about locally?
Locally, most of those types of concerts are done and are planned more short term. Therefore, I can say yay or nay with a little more confidence when it's only like a month or 2 months from now. I can say, but if it's a year from now, only the good Lord knows. So, and it could be something, I could be indisposed. Again, nobody knows the timing on these things. And there are some things, if we can relinquish control of things we really can't control, like the timing, you know, who wants to read the last chapter first anyway? I think I'm happy to read the chapter I'm on. And wait for how it turns out. It takes a certain amount of serenity to do that. We all, you know, life is not like the remote control. We can't just change the channel whenever we want. We have to tough it out.
There you go. Now, you're planning another Red Letter Day?
Yes, it's in the works. We're going to be sending out notices on it soon, and I've already got a theme for it. Last year was playing games. It was all about sports during the 19th and early 20th century, seen through the eyes of Professor Billy Phelps. And this time it's going to be women. And that's a very broad theme. I shouldn't have any trouble finding material on that. We have various diary and letter entries by various females from our archive. And there are many writings of Professor Phelps on the subject of women, which are very quaint today. He was so chivalrous, but to a fault. And I think that the attitudes of that time will give us all a smile when we think about how things are today. So I expect it'll be an attractive program.
And I expect that you'll be at the center of it as far as maybe a rendition or two?
I'll try to be. I know there's some beautiful songs to poems that Billy Phelps loved. And if I can possibly sing them myself, I'll do that. Again, I wouldn't carry an entire program by myself. I wouldn't have the strength for that. It'll be a long day. But if I can chime in for a few minutes, I'd love to do that.
Okay. Elizabeth, we're about out of time. Is there anything that you would like to add here to the listeners?
Well, to wish them well and to urge them to take good care of their health and to anticipate problems and not wait for something to happen, but anticipate and take care of your health and don't let this be you. Is that. And also, life can be very beautiful, and if there's a concert opportunity or an art exhibition or something wonderful and lovely to do, go do it. Don't wait, you know, because the chances are limited. They can dry up on you real fast. So live your life and be well.
Okay, thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you.